Deutschlandfunk Kultur. Sein und Streit.
Charles Taylor, you were born in Montreal, Quebec. That's a region in Canada where the majority of people speaks French and where both French and English are official languages. You have been raised bilingual. How has that shaped your view of the world and your thinking?
Oh, greatly. I mean, fundamentally, because I saw right away from home that speaking two languages is not just two different instruments of communication. It's a sense of humor. It's a whole outlook on life. It's a whole lot of reference points. And so I just never have been able to see language as simply an instrument. I see it as something that, you know, makes you what you are.
You have articulated that view in articles and books, language not merely as a means of sharing information, but of self-expression, also forming one's own identity. You have said we are the self-interpreting animal as humans, or the language animal. How do you come to believe so? Is there a special experience behind that?
I think it starts off with this experience of being bilingual in a world where most people aren't. So you hear the English talking about the French and the French talking about the English. And some people say, well, why are we wasting our time with two languages? Let's just use one language. We just need this as an instrument of communication. But you know from your experience that that's not true, right? So already you're very skeptical of views like that from your just lived experience day by day.
In recent decades, we have a vivid discussion on language in public, on, for example, gender-sensitive language, or also of so-called political correct ways of speaking. And many commentators would say this is going too far. In a liberal democracy, we have to endow people with the same basic rights, but one cannot regulate language in any way. What is your stance on this, with this background we have talked about?
Yeah, well, I have a double reaction. On one hand, of course, the way we address each other is tremendously important, and I can address you in a way which pushes you away from me. I talk to you as though you were an idiot, or I can address you as someone who I really want to speak to. But if we try to regulate that too much, then we begin to encroach on a domain where it's not positive, it doesn't have positive results for the state to intervene. So yeah, it's always going to be an area where we don't know quite where to draw the lines.
What can we do about that?
Well, I mean, the only thing that you can do positively is you can elaborate your own protocols of addressing people and hope that they spread. It's really, it ultimately comes down to looking at other people as, you know, it possibly interesting sources of a different experience than yours, which is really worthwhile talking to. The more you have that sense of things, the more you're going to find the right language to talk to people that doesn't alienate them. But it's that kind of, we need to develop a kind of sensitivity as human beings. And that happens in a very diverse society as long as you have substantial equality that will develop.
Quebec, which we already mentioned, is not only a region of different languages, but also of different cultures. And this leads us to the subject of multiculturalism and the politics of recognition. You have talked about that a great, you have thought about that and written about that a great deal. Why is public recognition of specific cultures so important?
It's important for us, and maybe it's important for us in a way it isn't for others. It may be becoming so for others. We are an immigrant society. For a couple of centuries, we've been taking people in from very different languages and backgrounds, and of course, more and more different because we used to have people coming from Asia and so on, and which we now do. So it's necessary to create a sense that we're all equal citizens. Now, very often in that kind of situation, the people who were there originally are kind of seen as, you know, really 100% citizens, and the others are seen as. And so it was necessary for us. What multiculturalism means is you don't have to be descended from someone in the British Isles or the French North to be a real Canadian. You're a Canadian on the same footing as everyone else if you come from Russia or Italy or India or China or Malaysia. That's what multiculturalism means in Canada. It's a kind of equalizing of people of all origins as Canadian citizens.
You have opted also, I mean, there is a tension there, right? We are granted with basic, or everybody is granted with the same basic rights, and we have to recognize maybe particular things which are important to particular groups. And you have opted for special rights for the French-speaking people in Quebec with the argument, it was back then, of cultural survival. Would you hold the same view, say, for Muslim women in Europe for wearing a headscarf?
Yeah, it's not the same issue, because we're not talking about a society founded around Islam the way we're talking about in Quebec, a society founded around the French language. So there we're dealing with people who are going to always be a minority. And yes, there it becomes very important to allow them to express themselves and allow them to practice their religion. Because we've started a civilization in which the right to practice your faith is a fundamental right. So as you start saying to people, you can't wear your headscarf here, your headscarf there, you're saying to them, you can't practice your religion here or there. You're not like other citizens in this society who can. And so that's something that we shouldn't go there, which very often we try to do, I have to admit, but we shouldn't introduce that those kind of interdicts in our cultural life.
But many people would say that there are situations where the state has to show neutrality for a school teacher, for a religion teacher at school. Is it a different thing to wear the headscarf, or maybe for a judge?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, you have to make a very special case, and I've never heard a really powerful case to make. There has to be some superior goal of public interest. Any of these rights are limited, but let's look at the kind of things that can limit them. If my expressing my religion in a certain situation is going to stop you expressing yours, and then we have a problem, we'll have to work out some kind. If the whole, you know, operation can't go on, I mean, for instance, in a given situation, a given enterprise, if somebody wants to take, you know, a great number of holidays, well, sorry, that will give a too great a burden to others, right? So you have these special reasons, which are very understandable, why we can limit fundamental rights in certain circumstances. But just because it's another religion isn't such a reason.
How can those two poles we are talking about be reconciled? The constitutional neutrality and the need for recognition of difference.
Well, I think they entail each other. You see, if the society is really neutral, then it's neutral between all religions. It's neutral between religion and non-religion. And if it's neutral in all those ways, then you can't start saying to people of one religion, you can't do things that people of other religions are doing, or people of no religion that you can't do things that people of religion are doing, or vice versa. See, it follows from neutrality, real neutrality. The trouble is there are people that have conceptions of secularism, or laïcité in French, which are not really neutral. They are really not entirely happy with religion, so they want to limit it in a certain way. But non-religion is fine. They can do whatever they want. That's not what I think is really a neutral state. That is a, you know, like an extreme case of Soviet Union. It's a militant state, militantly anti-religious, as there used to be militant states, militantly Catholic or militantly Protestant in the old days. And we hope we've gone beyond that kind of thing.
At the moment in Europe, we have to deal with an increasing amount of migration and with issues which arise from that. We have already touched them. Issues having to do with cultural difference. They seem to take center stage at present. What can we learn from the way Canada has dealt with those issues?
Well, I think it's more how all the societies on the western side of the, well, most on the western side of the Atlantic, how the experience has worked out. I think people panic when they see, for instance, that a lot of immigrants from a certain area are all together in one part of the city. But that always happens because if you come from, let's say, Pakistan, you don't know where to find a job. Ah, my brother-in-law has a house over there. So you tend to go with people. Now, we've seen that over a couple of centuries. The next generation is not like that, and the following generation is even less like that. So don't panic because people seem to be getting into ghettos. It's not something that will mean anything to them in the next generation. It means something now because they need the help of people from the same origin. And you know, in large countries like India, you go to a big city like Mumbai, well, the people who come from Gujarat are over here and the people who come from Madhya Pradesh are over there. The same thing happens. You arrive in a new society and without some kind of contacts, you don't get a job, you don't get a house, you don't know where to put your children in school. But when time goes by, we overcome that. So if you panic and do things that are discriminatory, then you perpetuate the ghetto, right? Whereas if you just take it in stride, it'll work itself out.
Charles Taylor, if things would have turned out differently in your life, maybe I would not be sitting here with the philosopher, but with the Canadian politician Charles Taylor. You were active in the New Democratic Party in the 60s. You were also running for the House of Commons, but then you lost to Justin Trudeau, I guess.
No, his father.
to Pierre Trudeau, the father of Canada's prime minister today. When you look back in that time, do you regret not staying in active politics?
Well, no, I've had such a satisfying life being able to write the things that I wanted to write, that I like to think that the electors of Mount Royal just thought I would write a better book on Hegel, and so they sent me into private life. So I'm really, they did me a favor in the end, I think, very likely.
But would you say, do we need more people with a philosophical background in politics?
I think we do. And people with a philosophical background ought to be more willing to dive into politics. And I haven't left politics altogether because I'm very involved in Quebec, as you know, and commissioned to look into reasonable accommodation. And I'm always intervening in the public debate. And I think we all should do that. If you have some kind of philosophical training and you can look at issues from that angle, you ought to get in there and fight. But it doesn't mean that you have to be a member of parliament, and I'm relieved that I didn't have that that path open for me.
Before studying philosophy, your family background was also political. You have already talked elsewhere about your childhood and that there was constant talk in your early child days in your family back then about Europe, about Germany, about the rise of Nazism. Mm-hmm. Do you think the political state of the world now is in any way comparable to that of the 1930s?
No, I mean, we're not. It's nothing like as bad. I mean, democracy is now threatened. It's threatened not by totalitarian societies, I mean, unless you look at China, but I mean, I don't see people voting for the Chinese solution in our societies, but it's not threatened as it was by Mussolini fascism or Hitler's Nazism or Soviet Stalinism. It's threatened by something more insidious, but less terrible. And these two go together, right? It's threatened by the kind of society you see in Russia, the kind of society you see building in Hungary, the kind of society you see in Turkey, where there are elections, there's even a few opposition media that are allowed to exist, but the thing is stacked so that the opposition never wins, right? In various ways, the judicial system is corrupted or something of that kind, so that you have these things which have the facade of democracy, which are easier to live in maybe than the old totalitarian, because if you just stay out of politics, no one's going to bother you, right? But they're a death for what we really understand as genuine democracy.
The British social philosopher Colin Crouch, or political theorist Colin Crouch, has called this state of the world post-democratic. Would you underwrite that term?
No, I mean, we're still very much in with a fight on this, and I intend to go on fighting to avoid this fate, although it's not as bad as the fate of certain countries in the 1930s. It's pretty terrible because there is something, I think, very noble and great about democracy, about people ruling themselves, accepting others as equals, working it out with them. This is, I think, a higher form of human life than being simply a subject. And so I think this is worth fighting for. And I don't think we're by any means fated to lose democracy. But there is a real threat.
You try to do something against this threat, for example, by coming here to Berlin and having a three-part lecture at the university, The Crises of Democracy, it's entitled, plural. What are the main seeds of fire in your view?
Well, I think that there are ways in which democracies can degenerate, and some of these are coming together to produce something even worse. I mean, one is that democracies can degenerate because they get to be very opaque and it's very unclear to ordinary people how they can influence them, so they stop voting, so they become even less influential, so more money comes into the system, so they become even less powerful, and you get a kind of despair on the part of ordinary people, which is a great danger for democracy. And then there's another kind of threat that is always there, that of democratic people, which needs to have some very strong sense of common identity, common purpose, common values, begins to divide because some people come to consider other people as not really fully citizens, right, for various reasons. And we have these two degenerations are coming together, and there's a sort of interference or synergy between them. That is, the people who have this sense that we can't affect things are being told by demagogues, well, the reason for that is that there's all these other people here who don't really belong, and the elites are favoring them against you, the way Trump spoke to the American population. And then it seems to be an answer to democratic impotence, democratic ineffectiveness becomes really the death of democracy as an operation of the whole people by deeply dividing the society. That's our crisis.
Let us look at these two main points you have mentioned. You have already said elsewhere that democracy, of course, means the rule of the demos, and that means the rule of the normal people or the non-elites. Is this that what you meant when you have said there is this constant promise which is only halfway fulfilled in democracies today?
Yeah, there is. I mean, what's interesting is that the word people in all European languages has a double meaning. It sometimes means everybody.
Yeah.
In a given polity, but it often means the common people. So when people say, I'm a populist leader, they don't mean I'm leading everybody. They mean I'm leading this group of people that haven't been really given their proper say.
The true people.
The true people or the, right? So I think there is this ambivalence in the word demos. I mean, not in Greek, it's very clear it means the non-elites, but in modern European languages. So that it's possible to avoid seeing that, but I think it's implicit in democracy that the demos in the Greek sense, that non-elites, should have their proper weight in the result, whatever the result turns out to be. And there are various things that block that, and that produces this sense of, well, ordinary people don't have a say, or how can I have a say, or how can I do something which will solve this or that problem that I'm living with, right? So I think that there's a democracy, I would call it a telic concept. That is, it's a concept with a promise built into it. The promise is never entirely met, never entirely realized, but there are periods when we're going towards it and periods when we evidently feel we're sliding away from it. And that latter is our description today.
But if we define democracy as the rule of the non-elites, isn't there the clear danger that we have always the contrast or the binarism of us versus them, the non-elites versus the elites. And nowadays, that often means for people like Donald Trump and others, the AfD in Germany, the global elites.
Not necessarily, because if the democracy works out well for a period, which it did after 1945, you get a kind of understanding, kind of Ausgleich, a kind of understanding between the different classes, as we did actually at the outset, I mean, after the Second World War, where we had welfare states, we had some degree of economic planning for full employment, we had vigorous trade unions, and this was respected by both more conservative people and more, let's say, social democratic people. So there was a struggle about moving it a little bit this way, a little bit that way, but the idea was that we all agree on these fundamental provisions. That would be a real democracy in which there was some kind of balance, and that's what we're aiming at. When you get this kind of division here that we have today, where other people are seen as not really citizens, they're not open to that anymore. They're not open to saying, well, we could find a way of living with these people by just, as it were, getting some, giving a little bit from each side. These other people that, you know, xenophobes are targeting, they shouldn't be here at all, or they should be here, but only in a more unequal and subordinate situation. See, there's no intention or no possibility in that mindset of working something out with these other people. And that's the death of democracy.
The second thing you have mentioned is the need for collective identities, for a we, which people maybe can root for to experience their participation in the democratic life as something which makes sense to them. And I wonder how we can create this kind of we without doing that which the populists do, without making this opposition between us versus them. How can we create something where, for example, in many European countries today, the migration gets more and more important. How can we create a we which acts together in a democracy and at the same time also recognize the claims which we have already talked about in the first part of the interview? Several people, special cultures having special needs. So how is this to be done in your view?
Well, it's done by actually putting forward solutions that can give something to everyone and fighting for them and getting them in place. So what we're saying to all our fellow citizens, and we've put forward a program of that kind, this is a way we can all live together. We're not asking you to disappear. We're not asking you to have your interests totally disregarded. We have a reasonable solution in which we can all find something that we can identify with. Now, we have differences. You on the other side of the political spectrum, you think it should be slightly different, but these are not two projects that are ultimately totally incompatible. There's some kind of synergy we can work out between them. That is the kind of discourse of a polity in which we accept that everybody has a legitimate place.
Right? So that would be a kind of constitutional patriotism?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think that word is a very good word because what we have in that kind of society is not just that everybody more or less believes in a certain ethic, but that we recognize that we are engaged in a certain historical project of realizing this. And patriotism means the emotions of pride and shame come in, right? We feel pride when we manage to realize this goal. We feel somewhat ashamed when we find we're falling away from it, and there's, you know, when some legislation passes in Quebec, which is discriminatory, I frankly feel ashamed. I don't want to live in this kind of society. But when we manage to find a place for everybody by creating a new way of living together, I feel pride. And I think that's what we're dealing with. Constitutional patriotism is the essential engine on which modern democracies work.
Maybe we can try and still dig a little deeper and tie this momentary crisis or crises to your analysis of the development which has led to our modern condition of today. You have written about this in The Sources of Self in great detail, and roughly speaking, please bear with me, I'm overly generalizing here, right? The subject has distanced itself from the rest of the world. It has become what you call a punctual self, confronted with the outside world in an instrumental relationship, right? Is this already the deeper source of today's crisis?
Yes, I think it's partly a source of today's crisis because the actual lived self is much richer than that, right? And one of the important things about the self as we actually live it is that it depends on recognition by others. It depends on being able to work with others in solidarity with others, building something and so on. And the stance of looking at the world as something to be worked on instrumentally is a stance which, if you push it far enough, is going to make that stance of working together impossible, right? You have to have the sense of we belong together, we are fundamentally allies, mutual recognition is important to each of us. You have to have that kind of sense if you're going to build a democracy in the modern world. So in a certain sense, if giving too much importance to the instrumental self is a threat to this kind of living together. Well, I mean, think of some of these large corporations today, particularly those involved in fossil fuels, who are lying to us because they know even better than we do that there's a terrible threat here. And they're telling us, no, there isn't. This is all exaggerated and so on. This is not the way that citizens can operate. I mean, this is treating us like children who can be instrumentally manipulated in order not to interfere with my interest, with our interest. You see, that kind of behavior is ultimately undercut citizenship. But the modern self is much, much richer than that. And democracy is one expression of that richer dimension.
So if I want to live myself, I have to do that in together with other people. I mean, I was thinking about all the developments we've had in recent years, which can be put under the header of neoliberalism, mm-hmm. which seems to me a little bit like the individual puts itself into a kind of instrumental mm-hmm. Zweckrationale relationship to itself. If you feel bad, you have to take care for yourself better. It doesn't have to do with the conditions we live together in a society. So maybe this development gets deeper and deeper.
Yeah, that's right. But those people who have that kind of attitude, they become incapable of solidarity. It doesn't mean anything to them. But a democracy lives by solidarity. So at a certain moment, they're risking losing the democratic life world that they now have. Which is really very serious in the end, because then who's going to run the show, right? Money will run the show, maybe, or even worse, there'll be manipulation from abroad. We're now seeing that Putin has this capacity to intervene in various important elections in Western countries like Brexit, like the American election, and so on. It's really quite a terrifying prospect, right? So, yeah, if one develops in this road of thinking more and more of oneself instrumentally in relation to the others, one is risking some of the really great creations of our Western civilization, the collective creations, which all require some degree of solidarity.
I mean, how can we, in liberal democracies today, if individualism plays such a big role, how can we bring people together to act for a common good?
Well, individualism, there's a certain dimension of individualism which doesn't divide us, you see. I mean, let's say that I am a great poet or a great artist and so on. Yeah, I can't be that all on my own, just off in the wilderness. I'm that because I create something that you and others find meaningful. And then, and vice versa, I'm inspired by certain other people to be that. So there are certain self-realizations that suppose that we live in a society of mutual recognition, right? Without that, they couldn't exist. And everybody feels this at a certain level, and they may suppress it because they're convinced that what they should do in life is, you know, make as much money as possible selling junk bonds or something of that kind. But everyone recognizes this need for other people at the level of, let's say, fully expressive human beings. And so this is something we can call up again in people's experience to defeat that kind of destruction of democracy.
But what can be the framework for that? I mean, elsewhere you have said we cannot do in today's world without patriotism. You have even declared yourself a, correct me if I quote that wrong, a liberal nationalist. No, I mean, this of course sounds very different if a Canadian says it than if a German would say it. How do you want to cope with that danger of a politics of exclusion at the same time we need something like a collective narrative?
Yeah, because we don't need to conceive our nationalism as living in a predatory relationship to that of others. I mean, that's what's remarkable about the European Union. We who aren't in it looking from abroad at it, we find it very admirable that you have not only persons identifying others that they're meaningful to them, but here we have nations accepting that we're living together in a common civilization in which we're learning from and gaining from the contact with others. And the sight of the European Union falling apart or destroying itself, I must say, awakens in someone like me from abroad in the other side of the Atlantic a great deal of anguish and pain and concern, because I think this is the direction that the human beings ought to be striving to go, where, yes, we have constitutional patriotism, we want our democracy to go well, but that doesn't have to be defined. That's to require that other people's democracy goes badly.
So what do you think then? Is it that we experience at the moment such a backlash? If we talk about the project of the European Union in that way, which you just did, everything sounds so simple, but this is not what we are experiencing at the moment.
Yeah, well, I think what happened, and this is, we get back to the first generation we talked about earlier, is that for a lot of non-elites, their situation, they find, getting worse and worse. For instance, you take the case of France, there's large parts of the northeast down to the northeast down to the southwest is a kind of band where industries are leaving, small communities are losing some of their members or losing some of their functions. No, their whole way of life is in decline, and they feel desperate about this. Nothing was done, really, because Europe was in a mode of saying, let's have austerity at all cost, I mean, after the 2008 crisis. So situation got worse and worse. And no one came along to say, we can make your situation better with a real plan. So other people came along with a plan that isn't going to do that at all, but blames some outsiders and feels very, you know, very persuasive. The democratic forces that are aware of what's happening in our society left the road open for demagogues, for Brexit, for the Front National, for Salvini, for the AfD. And we left people, we didn't address their needs, and we left it to the demagogues to take over, or in the United States even more, left it to Trump. I think we have been at fault here.
A common culture is something which lets people act together, or a common cause, but often this shared culture or common cause is defined with looking back into the past, and we have seen the dangers of that. You have said elsewhere that we have to try to root in the future. How do we do that?
Well, I think that the better way of putting it is that everybody, all societies, all democratic societies, live with a narrative, and the narrative has a past and a future. There's no question the narrative starts back there and it goes on to here and we project it forward. But there are two kinds of narrative, and a certain kind of narrative is anchored in the past in the sense that it's saying it was much better back then. You know? We've lost, and we have to go back. And another kind of narrative is anchored in the future. We can create something really better. Right? And I think you see these two narratives. Take the case of the United States. Right? Obama was saying, we can, to create a more perfect union. We start from the values of our founders, and they weren't very well put into operation then, and we're going to put them more and more and more into operation. The story is anchored in the future. Against him was the Tea Party, which looks back to 1774 and the refusal of paying tax on tea, right, and pouring it into the Boston Harbor. So looking backward to an earlier time when, things were much better. Yeah. I think that by the nature of things, only these forward-looking narratives really can give a solution to our problem.
Another example would be the Fridays for Future movement at the moment. Young people eager to participate, to have their voices heard, to effect change, everything seems so hopeless. Can this goal in the future create this we are looking for?
Exactly,
to act
yes.
for the common good?
Yeah, it can. You see this before your eyes, but these youngsters are teaching us a lesson that shame to say we're not able to teach ourselves, and maybe we aren't even able to rise to the occasion. But it's creating links across all countries, across all cultures, with a sense that, yes, we can build something better. It's wonderful to see that the human species hasn't lost this capacity. But we see it in our youngest members.
Is this something which gives you hope? Or
absolutely,
is there something
yes.
else?
Yes. It's that gives me hope. It's a continuing coming back of this desire to make things better, to work together, to create bonds across big differences. It's continuing to recur among young people in spite of all the battering it's had from us old-timers.
Charles Taylor, thank you very much for coming to the program.
Thank you.